Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and one central question following the election of Donald Trump: what shifts of policy and culture might we expect for women under President Trump? That's the question that'll be the focus of a sold-out panel tonight at New York Live Arts with six esteemed thinkers on how women's lives could dramatically change during the 45th U.S. presidency. With us now are two women who are participating in tonight's panel: Margot Jefferson, winner of a Pulitzer Prize for criticism. She teaches writing at Columbia and is the author of On Michael Jackson and the memoir Negroland. And joining her is Catherine Stimson, university professor and dean emerita of the Graduate School of Arts and Sciences at NYU. She's the founding editor of Signs, Journal of Women in Culture and Society, and the author most recently of Critical Terms for the Study of Gender. Welcome back to WNYC, Catherine, and welcome to the show, Margot. Good to have both of you.
Oh, thank you, Brian.
Thank you.
And if we've got an NYU professor and a Columbia professor, we've got common ground right away. We've bridged one of the big divides.
Yes, right.
Catherine, the panel was organized before the election, so I guess the conversation you're going to have tonight is different than the one you anticipated.
Just a little bit. Just a little bit. One thing about it, Brian, and I hope Margot agrees with me, is I have a different set of feelings, obviously, than I would have had if Mrs. Clinton had won. And certain feelings have been intensified and sharpened. And among them is the sense, well, it's back to the trenches. It's back to the kind of political and cultural struggle one had 50 years ago. And an obvious example of that is the degree and hatefulness of misogyny. I had thought, in the United States, in my naive utopian way, that misogyny had been diluted. Not so. I think we're seeing a new toxic strain of it, which is shown in the demonization of Mrs. Clinton. Now, you could have voted for Mrs. Clinton, or you could have voted for Mr. Trump. But no matter who you voted for, even a blank, she's not a witch. She is not a devil. She is not running child sex rings in the back of a pizza parlor in Washington, D.C.
As that fake news story had it, and that guy went into the pizza place and shot it up with a rifle, or fired one shot with a rifle last night. Margot, one of the lesser covered points relating to what Catherine said at that Harvard forum last week between the campaign managers of the Clinton and Trump campaigns, we heard a lot about that particular exchange on white supremacy between Jennifer Parmieri and Kellyanne Conway. But one of the folks there said the internal polling by the Clinton campaign discovered that voters related to Hillary more like they generally relate to male candidates and not like they relate to female candidates. And I didn't hear an elaboration of what exactly that meant, but I wonder if that strikes you in any way.
No, I didn't hear an elaboration of what that meant either. It would seem to me that assuming there's truth in that, that what Hillary Clinton got was the worst of both worlds, that voters related to her with all of the negatives they might associate with a man that were magnified because she's a woman. And we would hear these kinds of complaints. She's so cold. You know, she's untrustworthy. She's cynical and self-serving. These are the kinds of charges that have been brought against establishment male candidates. Yeah. Then you add the demonic, crazed, the woman tropes that Catherine just talked about, and you've got an absolutely toxic combination.
How do you explain the percentage of white women who did not vote for Hillary Clinton.
Oh, I think there are many explanations. And one of them is a woman is more than a woman. We have genders. We have a gender, but we're more than that. A combination of things go into our identity. And I think some white women voted for Mrs. Clinton, against Mrs. Clinton, because they wanted change, because they felt economically vulnerable, because they felt the rug of white Christian superiority being taken away from them. And I say that as a white Christian woman. And they felt, I think, the consequences of those decades of assaults and attacks on her. When I look back at the election and the role of gender and all the other complicating factors in it, Brian, and I hope Margot would agree with me, I think it's a tribute to our nation that she beat Mr. Trump by over 2 million votes in the popular vote.
True.
There was a great deal of support for her, and that means a great deal of support for a woman presidential candidate. Is the glass half empty or is the glass half full? It's a glass filled with water. That's and one can interpret the degree of water as one wants.
Margot, I believe you said with Hillary Clinton there was a mythology of the liking. Do I have that phrase right?
Mythology of disliking?
Of, I think I said maybe it's disliking.
Disliking is what I said, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Well, there certainly, Catherine outlined, you know, the really generational buildup, the decades buildup of demonic, monstrous, manipulative, cold, witch-like, with powers beyond imagining Hillary. Those internal polls that you're talking about suggest to me that, like, a number of women in any position of authority across economic and professional boundaries, this question, which I, too, thought was a little, you know, more less primitive than it is, this question of acting like a man, claiming male prerogatives, in some way de-sexing yourself, losing your feminine allure, charm, appeal, that this is still really disturbing
some
to many men.
Some have said since the election, like Columbia professor Mark Lilla, that this election signals that liberals need to refocus their rhetoric away from identity politics. He says identity
politics. I'm sorry.
Well, just for people who haven't read his article, a widely shared article in the New York Times, he said identity politics, which aim to unify and include, are actually fracturing. Go ahead.
I just want to say, I can say many things, but white prejudice, discrimination, bigotry, racism, the rebirth of white supremacist ideologies, what are these things if they're not identity politics? And may I point out, they've had centuries-long history in America. Mm-hmm. So why did identity politics suddenly become special interest, selfish, divisive, when it was associated with discriminated against groups who were struggling for their rights, culturally and politically?
I think that's right. And the use of the term identity as a political term begins in the 1960s with the struggle for equality and with the struggle to rid ourselves of the psychological and social and cultural scourge of discrimination. I read Professor Lilla's article. I didn't freak out over it. He's a very smart guy. I think the point that's important to take away from that is you can't reduce people to one source of identity. You can't say you're a lesbian and nothing else. You can't say you're Latina, Latino, and nothing else. That what I wish people thought about a little bit more is how many sources of identity
yes.
we have.
Yes,
and
yes.
how complex we are. And which part of our identity is loved, which part of our identity is despised, and how do those parts of our identity work together, and then how do we take them into the world of civic obligation and civic trust and civic discourse and civic action. You know, Brian, it's wonderful to be here on the show with Margot, but I wish we had 20 minutes to talk about identity politics. And if the Democrats made a mistake, I think it was, in discussing demographics, was to reduce complicated demographics to one term.
I think that is terrific. I entirely agree with that. So, you know, what Catherine is beautifully arguing for, you know, is an expansion of our sense of politics as they are affected, shaped by our identities. You know, it's as if you know, one is not, I am, for example, I am African American, I am a woman, I am of a certain age, you know, and I am of the upper middle class. All of these identities function, and each one can affect me advantageously or disadvantageously according to a wide range of situations, which I must analyze and respond to.
You see, part of the paradox of the right, the white supremacist right claiming identity politics, part of the paradox is they lack gratitude to the left for giving them this set of terms. And part of the difficulty, Brian, is white Christianity is not a theology of domination. Mm. White Christianity is not a theology of white supremacy. And is a part of the toxicity of white supremacy is that it takes Christianity and makes it into a religion of domination and supremacy. And that is not what Christianity is. All souls are equal. But let me say one thing more.
But can I follow up on that?
Please.
Because hundreds of years before there was anything that anyone called the left, let's say in the 1600s, there were white Christians fleeing religious persecution in Europe who were enslaving Africans.
You know, you're absolutely right. And one of the most marvelous parts of Frederick Douglass's 19th century autobiography is when he talks about the slave owners holding their hideous little church services and not permitting the blacks to learn how to read so they could read the Bible for themselves. But they did. Brilliant, brilliant people. They did learn how to read for themselves. But the white slaveholders cherry-picking the Bible for passages that would justify their supremacy. And, you know, the Bible is the most extraordinary set of texts. But it is a cherry tree. And you can find a little bit of something to justify almost anything. But if I could, Brian, if we have the time, I want to go back to something that I don't want to get lost. And that is, though Margot and I have both spoken for the complexities of identities, nevertheless, there are issues that impact women more than other groups. And do I approach a Trump administration with a certain amount of fear? Yes.
Yes.
Do I find fear energizing? Yes. Fear is not a taser gun. Fear is a spur to action. And Brian, here are the issues. Women's health. Abortion, which is inseparable from women's health. Pay discrimination. If he asked Congress to repeal the Ledbetter Act, I think this would be a very bad sign. Child care and family care, that though that affects men and women equally. Rape and crimes of sexual violence. So there are all these issues that we can legitimately call women's issues because they impact women more than other groups. But saying that, we also have to recognize how complicated we are. I sit here talking to one of the most brilliant interviewers on radio, and I'm just thinking about how complex your identity is and how many things have gone into the making of this person called Brian Lehr.
It would be true for anybody. Margot?
It's also true that every social issue impacts and is impacted by women. Ben Carson, recently appointed Secretary of Housing and Urban Development. This means that women living alone, in families, in every kind of partnership, straight women, LGBT, are all potentially at the mercy of terrible decisions about public housing, you know, cities. This is huge. Discrimination, gender, sexual, in, you know, everything, the military, employment. Again, there's no issue that doesn't affect and isn't affected by the lives of women.
We're almost out of time. On the day after the inauguration, that would be Saturday, January 21st, there's expected to be a very large demonstration in Washington, D.C., and I gather that the organizing principle of this is around women's issues. I have a feeling a lot of people who are horrified by the election of Donald Trump for a lot of different reasons are going to come. But are you familiar with this as it's taking shape and how closely it revolves around particular women's issues?
I know.
Every woman I know is talking about it.
I think we have to wait to see if a permit is given.
That's still a question?
As far as I know, but I don't want to spread false rumors. In a time when there are too many false rumors, I don't want to spread false rumors.
Assuming the permit, then what's the message?
I think the message is first that the march will happen, especially if lots of people come. The message, there is energy around these issues. Again, always recognizing that women's issues are large issues that impact more than women. But the message would be, let me put it colloquially, don't mess with my body. Don't mess with my soul. Don't mess with my equality. Don't you dare.
I love it. I second that emotion, indeed, and that thought.
And I guess that is where we will leave it, with Pulitzer Prize winner Margot Jefferson. She teaches writing at Columbia and is the author of On Michael Jackson and the memoir Negroland, and Catherine Stimson, university professor and dean emerita of the Graduate School of Arts and Science at NYU. She's the founding editor of Signs, Journal of Women in Culture and Society, and the author most recently of Critical Terms for the Study of Gender. And I guess I shouldn't promote your panel tonight because it's already sold out. Will it be streamed or anything like that so people without tickets might be able to gaze in on it?
Stay tuned, Brian. But thanks very much for asking, and thanks so much for having us here.
Okay. Yes, many thanks.
Thank you both very, very much. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. John Calipari next. Stay with us.